Hi there, everyone. My name's Darcy. I'm the editor of the Stage Left podcast. I'm just dropping in before this episode begins to let you know that we have a brand new merch line available right now. I'm currently wearing one of our black hoodie designs, which has the Stage Left podcast logo on the front, as well as on the back. But on the back, it's filled with all the guests that have appeared on the Stage Left podcast. I also have one of our notebooks here, which I absolutely love. It keeps me organised with everything in the podcast. It's ring-binded and lined as well for my convenience. And I just take it everywhere I go so that I always have my notes with me. It's up to date. And it's a small, compact size as well, which helps me save space in my bag. If you want to go check it out, we also have mugs, t-shirts, stickers, more hoodie designs and tote bags as well for you. So head to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me to check out all of our merch and help support the podcast so that we can keep producing free educational content for you all. Without further ado, let's get on with the episode.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for emerging musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring members of Radiohead, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Stone Roses, Elbow, Queen, Earth, Wind and Fire, Guns N' Roses, Fleetwood Mac, Madness, Oasis and Kraftwerk, who discuss their writing, recording and performing processes, as well as reflective interviews with the likes of Stuart Lee, Miles Copeland III, and musicians and producers who worked in the studio and on stage with the Beatles, Bjork, Beyonce, Elvis Presley, and David Bowie. Today we're joined by one of the most versatile and quietly essential musicians working right now, a multi-instrumentalist, collaborator, and musical chameleon, who's carved out a career moving seamlessly between worlds. From building the foundations literally in construction, to studying mathematics at Plymouth University, to standing stage left to some of the biggest artists in the world, Willie Bish has shaped a path that's anything but conventional. He's worked closely with artists such as C-Mat, The Japanese House and Declan McKenna in wildly different sonic universes. Today we'll be diving into Willie's early life, his formative influences, the sacrifices he's made, his evolving role across the different bands, what fun really means in the studio, and we'll explore Euro Country, Jamie Oliver's Petrol Station, rehearsal rooms and myth busting in the music industry. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage of Podcast is none other than Willie Bishop. Thanks to join us today, Willie. How's it going?
Hey, Chris. Yeah, good. Very good. Extremely good. After that, you know, decorated intro there, that's amazing. Yeah, very, very well.
Interesting to see your life mirrored back to you in that way. It, I guess, seemed like
very odd. Yeah,
1 minute 28 seconds.
I know. It was a huge passage. I felt like I was. It was like life before death. It was like flashing past my eyes. Great.
Love it. Now, we're recording this after you recently got back from a tour in Australia. It's a long way to go for a series of gigs. And, you know, I know people in bands who like want to play in Australia, but it's like such a like logistical ordeal to get out there and do the whole thing. How was it and what were your highlights of that tour?
Yeah, it was great. It's definitely a long way to get out there. It's like, you know, and it's interesting. I was talking to people while I was out there that tour around there regularly. They kind of, and it's you basically have to just fly throughout the whole place. So it was great. It was huge, lovely sunny weather, like amazing place. The crowds out there are really great, but it's just like, yeah, it's a long way to get out there and you have to fly. Yeah, so we were up like, you know, up at 6 to get to a flight, and then we do the flight, land in Melbourne. I think the tour basically, we actually went to Cancun in Mexico to start the tour, I suppose. So we did this festival with Brandy Carlile, which was great. And amazing festival that was like a country and Western festival in Mexico, which was amazing. But then we had to, that kind of came in last minute. So we had to basically fly from Mexico overnight. And it was like a 40-hour journey in total. So it was like, crazy start to the tour because we had to go straight from Mexico, this lovely 5-star resort, which was great. But then we had to then dive into like a 40-hour plane and car journey to get to Perth to start the Australian tour. So it was, we kind of all started the tour extremely tired, so we were just like knackered from the talk, from the journey. So
I can't imagine a better person though that CMAT to bring up the energy, right? Because I'd imagine she's just like a bundle of energy everywhere she goes, right?
Yeah, she's always like, yeah, stopping, yeah, she's always good vibes on the road. She's never has like a, you know, if there's a moment of strife, it's always met with like good vibes, and we're all kind of like, you know, in it together. So it's like, you know, good. Yeah, she's a great person to talk with, because it's just like always a good energy about the whole crew. It's just like, yeah, really good at getting on with it.
And your show, I'd imagine playing Australia and tour and playing all those different places. Like, how were you using all the equipment you would have done if you were doing a show in the UK, or is it a case that you're like borrowing other stuff or hiring other stuff from different places? Because it's such a logistical challenge to get all that stuff over there that you're used to.
Yeah, it was. It's hard. We did not do that. No, we kind of did a sort of half and half, kind of split a rental system. Frankenstein kind of like, you know, pieced together sort of model of what we'd usually use in the UK and, you know, Europe. So we flew two guitars. We flew one of my basses. We flew a couple of guitars and an acoustic. And then when we land, we basically rent a drum kit, a piano. We had a violin as well. So I think we flew two violins. So we've got Holly Carpenter, our violin fiddle player now, she has to play two fiddles because one of them is drop D fiddle.
Yeah.
Which is sick. It's not drop D. It's a half step down. So, yeah, she basically has to play, and she can't really tune between songs, like tune it up between songs.
Yeah.
So we had two violins. Luckily, violins are pretty easy to fly with because you just put them in the overhead locker, and that's great. But yeah, if you're flying like, I mean, you can put an acoustic guitar in the, you know, we put our acoustics in the holds and everything, you know, that works quite well. It works as a, you know, a luggage slot, so you just put it in the hold and you're away. But the Nord, we were going to bring a big piano, and it's like it costs a lot of money to bring a piano because it's like you've got to fly it, and then every flight you're getting on and off, and it's a lot of like admin to get into the airport, load it on, get the, you know, pass it through, you know, through security, and just get it all kind of checked in. It's annoying. Yeah, it's very annoying.
Did that mean when you arrived in Perth, you were plugging into an amp that you haven't actually played in before? And was it a case that you had rehearsals or to familiarise yourself? Or was it a case sound check and that was it?
Yeah. No way. We don't get rehearsals. We don't need rehearsals. We didn't get rehearsals, no. I mean, our rehearsal was basically going straight on to doing this Brandy Carlile show. We did have like 3 or 4 days in a 5-star resort in Mexico, which is not a rehearsal, but it definitely got us acclimatized to the setup, which is quite good.
But what about like the exact sound that you want from that amp? Like, is it a case that you're quite happy just to plug in on the day and work with what you got, or some people are really particular of like, no, this is my precious particular sound?
I've given up on that ethos over the time, because I don't, you know, I would love to be so particular about, and I mean, I can be very particular about like the tone that I want to hear and the tone that I'm kind of got in my head. But, you know, when you're doing, when you're doing shows, when you're doing festivals, when you're doing gigs, sometimes it's just not like logistically, it's just, it gives you a harder time if you're trying to chase something. And actually a better performance, you know, if you'll give a better performance if you're just like accepting of like how something sounds and like just go with like a very basic idea of like, you know, levels. As long as you can hear what you're playing, then you're basically just giving all that kind of like tone control. If you're just giving that to the front of house engineer and being like, okay, you're in control of how this sounds, I'm basically going to just send a DI bass guitar, or, you know, with bass it's pretty simple because it's just like, you know, if I send a DI bass signal, then that will be workable. If you can get used to working with a DI'd bass, then you'll be good, because you can always send a DI'd bass guitar, which is
But you do care about your sound, because I noticed that you play with your fingers on Eurocountry, but you play with a pick on Take a Sexy Picture and Stay for Something, right? So when does that decision making process happen, which way you're gonna go?
Yeah, it's kind of sorry. Yeah, it used to be I love playing with a pick. I do, you know, I love the tone, and a lot of the record is played with a pick. Because Ollie Deacon, Kira's producer, he amazing bass player, incredible bass player, music, multi instrumentalist, awesome dude. Just like, and he tracked all the parts himself on the record. And Kira and Ollie, they worked together in the studio in New York, doing all the tracking everything down. So they get everything down in the studio, and it's mostly it's like. Yeah, it's mostly sort of like picks, P bass, you know, a P bass with a pick, just like pluck, you know, that's sort of like country, almost simulating like, I always think of the Wichita Lineman bass line that's played on the, you know, terrible rendition, but it's just like really springy reverb, like, picked bass on like the baritone guitars, you know, like the baritone, the six string baritone, or no, not baritone, sorry, just like the six string bass, you know, there's they used them in the 60s and in the, you know, 50s, I guess. But yeah, those like America, it's got such a, there's a tone to it, which Ollie likes. So I try and go to that as like a style. But then as soon as we start playing live, it's like, the energy that we all bring to the music, it ends up needing more body. So I'll usually go to my fingers if it's like, and also like the feel. I love just groove. I'm such a, you know, a hound for the groove. I'm a sucker for the groove. So, you know, with the pick, you can get a good, you know, you just can't really get the same feel. Like when you're playing with fingers, it's like you can really lock into the feel of like the drums. And like when you're listening to the drums, I'm constantly just listening to what Hannah's playing and just like moving around what Hannah's playing. So, which, and the pick kind of just doesn't give the same, well, it's a different attack. So you're kind of, also that's the other thing, the attack that you have when you're playing a pick is like way harder, way more. So it's like sometimes you don't want to be on top of the mix in that way. Like you want to be behind everything, because if you're, you know, good bass player, you can sit in the back and just kind of have everything sit on top of what you're playing, and it's like that's the where you get the ultimate mix from. So.
And what's your ideal mix on stage for a CMAT gig? So if you were to think of all the gigs that you've been on stage and thought this sounds great for you, regardless of what the front of house are doing, what do you most need?
That's a good one. It does, it dives straight in with an answer. It would be a mix of everything. Like I'd literally, you know, the ideally I'd just be hearing what the front of house is hearing. Like that would be quite good, because I actually don't, I find it more distracting if I've got too much of myself. Like I don't really like listening to what I'm playing in some sense. Like I prefer having, you have to have a bit of what you're playing, and like to actually, you know, but it's actually more helpful if I'm just hearing what Hannah is playing, and like my fingers know what they're doing. So it's like I can kind of, I've got to a stage now where I don't really have to hear what I'm playing to know what I'm playing, because I can feel what it's going to sound like. So in situations where my mix is bad, or, you know, we're pretty tight now. We've traveled with our own desks and we've got a pretty good setup. So it's never bad, but like there are times where it's like, you know, you have to sort of like just get through.
Let me ask you this question, right?
Yeah.
So we had a guy called Ralph Roll on a while ago, and he talked about his worst case scenario, which was he's a drummer of Chic, and he was doing a David Bowie tribute after Bowie had died at the Grammys, and like Lady Gaga singing with this kind of computerized like face with all different Bowie images on there, and it's lots of different time signatures because it's different songs, like slow ones like Space Oddity and Let's Dance or whatever. He didn't have the click. Someone had muted.
Oh my god! It totally happens. It's amazing that it's on a show of that scale that something like that could happen. But
so
what's
the worst case scenario for you in a CMAT gig that you'd lose? If someone said, "Right, okay, we've got a balanced mix of everything," what's the worst thing you'd want to lose in that situation?
The worst thing, I mean, luckily for me, it's like I actually could lose. I've done this has happened before. Like, we wear packs, and like, you know, these wireless packs which transmit all the stuff that you hear in your in-ear mix, and they run out of battery. They always run out of battery. So, or they can run out of battery. Ideally, they don't run out of battery, but they do sometimes. And there's a moment where you're just like, you've got your ear, I've got molded in-ear headphones, so I can't hear anything, and all I can hear is like a faint sort of whisper of the drums. But actually, all that I need to play is the drums. So, you know, all the other stuff that's going on, as long as I'm locking in with the drums, I'm usually pretty good. Like, I can get through a song because I know what my fingers are doing. I know what this is sounding like, and I can hear the drums. So that's the only two things I really need. But let's think of a terrible... So that would be the worst case scenario. But I suppose even worse than that would be that you've got too much of something. Like, if you get too much, like an overwhelming amount of... Like, sometimes you'll miscommunicate. Oh, can I get a bit less of this? And it's just like the monitoring engineer will just misinterpret what you said, and they'll just push, oh, more of, you know, the backing vocals. And they'll push the backing vocals, and you'll just get loads of noise. And like, that's probably where I get most most disoriented, is when like there's too many microphones and it's just like too loud. And anything where you're just like, you've got too much of something, and you're just like, oh my gosh, I can't get away from this. And you're just having to like deal with the unbearable, unbearably loud sort of like noise. Or too much of your own instrument. Like, sometimes, you know, I'll get too much bass, and it's like, oh, that's the other thing. Sometimes if I get too much bass in my ear, or too much of your own instrument, it affects how you're playing. So like, you know, I went through a kind of a learning curve this year of being like, okay, if I have too much bass, then I end up playing, when I'm recording, I quite like it. If I've got loads of bass and you play just like really softly, and you're not really digging in that much, so you're just like letting the compression and letting the kind of the gain level just do the playing. So you're basically allowing yourself to just like, the gain is doing all the level, and you're not really having to play that much with your fingers. But for front of house, some that's terrible. So, you know, you basically, what you want is to just have a consistent, I mean, you can do that, but you just need to kind of, if front of house doesn't know that's what you're doing, then they're just like, what the fuck is my dad swear?
Yeah, you can swear as much as you
want. Can I swear? Okay, sorry. I love swearing. It's my favorite.
That's great.
It's good swearing.
Especially at front of house if they get it wrong.
Yeah, true. It's a good way to communicate exactly what you mean. It's swearing. Yeah.
So one of the assumptions I made about you, wrongly, I think, is that when I saw you playing with a pick, I was like, okay, started out as a guitarist. And then went to bass, right? What was your first instrument?
That is somewhat of a correct assumption, yeah, because I did start as a guitarist, yeah. I used to play guitar, was a guitarist all through my childhood, my teenage years, but also a bass player. I probably got my first bass when I was like, I think I was probably about 15 or 16, maybe. It was kind of like, you know, there was I used to live really close to this auction house. So there was like a auctioneer guy that would be like, an auction house, whatever, if you know what that is. So they'd always have like, you know, a bass instruments for like going for like, you know, 30 quid, 40 quid. And it was just like, oh, you know, great. That's sold. I'll get like a bass guitar. I think this is my first bass over here. Can you see this?
Oh, nice. It's slightly out of camera shot, but yeah. Oh, there we go.
Nice. Yeah, there nice. A P-bass. A Fender Precision is my first bass. So, and you, literally, that's the best bass I own today. It's great.
Wow, that's cool.
I still use it. It's great. It's like, you know, a P-bass works brilliantly. It's like, does everything that you would ever need to do. And the best thing to learn on, because it's like, It's really good.
We've got a lot of emerging musicians as listeners, and I'm interested in your dynamic with perhaps like your family and how encouraging or not encouraging they were about you going into the music industry, because there'll be people now who, like, listening to this will be like maybe between 16 and 23, and there will be voices in the background. In the background going, get a proper job. How did you navigate that, and what enabled you to, you know, at a very young age, you're playing with Declan McKennell and like Stephen Colbert show and playing these huge shows at Glastonbury and stuff like that at a very young age. What kind of enabled you to do that from that perspective?
There's never that much overwhelming. I don't know. I think it's just like something that happens in the UK. I still have that today. I still think I see my friends that have like normal jobs, and I'm like, that's so cool. It's not necessarily I've got like negative, I'm having like oppressive negative, like, feedback from people being like, you should get a real job, you know? But it's just like, I see people that have a real job, and I'm like, damn, that looks actually so much, I don't know. Then at the same time, I'm like, my job fucking rules. Yeah, I've got such a sick job. And it's like, I love my job. And I actually love my job, which a lot of people don't love their job. So it's like, I've got friends that basically they just clock it, you know, they do 9 to 5s Monday to Friday, and then they don't have to, and when they clock off at 5, it's like, okay, I don't have to think about that at all anymore. And like, that's great. That's great in some sense, but then in other senses, it's like music is just so intrinsic to everything that I love. And it's just like a whole part of my personality and my being is like, you know, interlinked with music. So the fact that I get to do music as a job and it's like all encompassing is just like such a blessing. And it's like, I wouldn't change it for another job, even if it meant that I got, you know, was more. It was more reliable, or it had more, you know, security. It's like, actually, I'd prefer doing this over something that had more security or better, you know.
That freelancer lifestyle of, there's a word that screams out immediately. It's like security. It's like job security.
Yeah, exactly.
And, having done this for 10 years, interviewing stage left musicians, i.e. the person who's not necessarily the front person, like, there is very little job security when it comes to these type of things. Like, your work is in the hands of someone else saying, I'm going to do, you know, someone might say, I'm going to take 2 years off or whatever. I think a lot of people do like that portfolio career, so do teaching or other things in the background, which can, you know, I mean, our mutual friend Gabby, she's just, headline Glastonbury, and you know, she does loads of teaching, that one-to-one coaching, teaching on drums and stuff like that. So I think that's probably the best way to one of the best ways to deal with it. But
it is totally,
you know, you are what I would say is, you said, like, 9 to 5's like that novelty will wear pretty soon, mate. Like, I'm telling you, I reckon, like, playing those shows you did at Glastonbury, I reckon probably drum any 9 to 5 that you get. But I hear where you're I hear where you're coming from. How did you So you at a very young age, or all of Declan's band were really young age, including Declan, when you became like quite stratospherically big on the music scene and playing really high profile individual gigs, or like, as I say, like American late night TV shows and that type of thing. Yeah. If you look back, what do you think you did really well in that situation that allowed you to thrive at that young age? And is there anything you do differently?
Yeah. So what we did really well, I mean, the best thing to do is to just literally throw yourself into any situation and just give yourself to it and be like, you know, I think one thing I didn't do was, I didn't think about it in terms of, I didn't really think what I was doing. I was just like, okay, I just have to, you know, bring my passion for music and just let it sort of like open it up and let it go on what I'm doing. And that's the best, you know, and just not have too much, don't have any hesitation in terms of like what it is, how you should be doing something. Because it's like, you know, I think if you overthink what it is that you're doing, you'll just do a bad job. You'll just do it like worse than if you've just been really like earnest in your passion for music and just like giving yourself to it in a way that's like, you know, genuine and authentic and just like, you know, some bands, yeah, there's one thing, yeah, some bands that do, and this is something that I kind of learned through joining Declan's band and like working with Declan and his band. It was like, I kind of, you know, just trying to be like a cool musician that's like, you know, sometimes you can, especially when you're younger and you have like, you're self-conscious, you're doing something that's just like the opposite of, you know, I'm not particularly like, it's kind of weird that I work in the music industry because I'm not a particularly like outgoing, you know, like extroverted person. Like, I don't know, I've got a sort of introverted side to myself. So, you know, as well as an extrovert side, I'm kind of like a split on the spectrum somewhere. But it's like, you have to conquer your own, you know, that kind of self-conscious muscle that tightens when you do live performance. You have to kind of learn to let it relax. And actually the best way to, instead of trying to create like an image, you know, like an idea, you know, your own, create this method for your own kind of like performance, it's better to just like get to a place. It takes a while, and it took me a while to kind of like relax into just like being a performer and being like a musician. And you know, I think being a Declan's fan really allowed me to do that, because it was like, Declan's really, you know, he's a really fun performer, and he just like, he loves performing, he loves, you know, letting people kind of like, you know, explore the songs in through their performance. And it's like, you know, it's and he loves, you know, those kind of performances that let people be more extroverted. I don't know, you know, but you know,
it's, who do you become on stage that you're not off stage?
I guess I'm the same person. I'm the same person. I'm always the same person. That's also something that you have to be like careful of. I've gone through phases being like, oh, I'm Willie Bish, I'm like some performer, and I've taken on this performance role, and it's like, that's actually not that helpful. And it just doesn't, obviously there's, so what is helpful is if you can like switch it on and off, is quite good. Like, there's
switch what on and off though, specifically? Yeah. What's the it?
The it in that would be switching your performative self. I don't know. Nice. I don't really know. It's kind of like, you know, switching on this, performance mode or something, so that you can do, it's funny when you do TV shows, you see people do, I was doing a TV show recently, and the host will go like, oh, ladies and gentlemen, tonight we have in the studio, blah, blah, blah. And he'll switch it on. And like, you know, we did the Graham Norton show a few weeks ago. And, you know, all these people, it's so amazing that they've got this ability to be able to just like, you know, be, you know, when they're relaxing, they're not, you know, they've got this, I don't know what it is. Yeah, what is it? But, you know, when they're interviewing people, they'll be so on. They'll be like, you know, talking to people, drawing the conversation in certain directions, and just like orchestrating themselves and being so like present with the audience and being so like present. I guess it's like presence to the situation. And then, you know, when you're off, you can just put headphones on and look at your phone, or like, you know, be less, you know, interactive with your environment. I don't know.
What were the sliding doors moments in your career that means that we have the version of Willie Bishop now, not the version who maybe didn't quite make it in the music industry, or is doing a different job, or whatever it might be? Like, there's always probably one or two moments that I luckily met this person, or I was at this gig, or I was, what do you think are the, there's another version of you, if you believe string theory, you know, doing something else right now.
Yeah.
You know? What were those pivotal moments?
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely been, there's been pivotal moments for me. There's always been like, there's been people, you know, that I've met that have just like led. I mean, there was, meeting Amber. I met Amber at the Japanese house. I met her when I was about 16 at a party, and she was 14. She's 2 years younger than me.
Wow.
So we met at a party, and she slammed her fingers in a door And I basically, she trapped her fingers in a door and was just like crying and just really upset. So I took her outside and called her dad and said, Amber's just trapped her fingers in a door. Can you come pick her up? Because she's crying. And her dad came and picked her up and took her off. And then from then we were just like very close friends for, you know, since then we've been very close friends. We'll always be close from forever from now on. Yeah. It's just like we're really close buds. So, but yeah, meeting her, we kind of, you know, we were so into music. We loved music. We were really into the Strokes and like Velvet Underground. And we'd, you know, sit in her garage and just like listen to records and just like, yeah, just explored the ideas of like being musicians, I suppose. We weren't really, you know, I guess we weren't really thinking about it too much, you know, but we were just like, yeah, both loved music. So we got on really well because we both loved music. And yeah, and then we started our first band. We were called Wilbur, the first band. So we kind of, I was playing drums.
Shoot your first names and surnames to, put together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Nice. So it was, my dad actually came up with that band name. Okay. It was great, which I say is a great band name. But yeah, I was playing drums then. So I'd take my snare drum and, you know, breakables, and we'd go into London and do like open mic nights. And we'd do like gigs with other bands from the area that were like going into London to do gigs. So we did a lot of gigs. Well, not those gigs, but it just felt, you know, it was so fun. It was literally amazing doing that because it was just like we were on the train into London. And it was just like so amazing. Met Cal Lavelle, if you know Cal Lavelle. She's a songwriter from, well, she lives in London. She used to put us on. She put us on one night to do a gig in the pub that she kind of worked at and was doing. She was setting up music nights there. She's, yeah, written songs with Ed Sheeran, and she's like songwriter, massive songwriter now. I actually met her at the Ivor Novello Awards last year and was like, Cal, I can't believe where we've got to. It's crazy, yeah. So yeah, meeting Amber, and then
would I be right in saying that when Dirty Hit signed Japanese House, that would have been quite a pivotal moment? So
hugely, yeah.
That talk us like, through those early days, because I think you even worked with George and Matty, right, from 75s on some of the recordings.
Yeah, it was. That was all very. It was fairly. Sort of, it was all remote in those days. Amber was basically, she's such a fierce solo musician. It was, we did lots of like Wilbur recordings back in the day, but then as soon as she started doing the Japanese house music, and basically she met the Dirty Hit guys through a friend and through like, Friendly Fires, Ed from the Friendly Fires. They were working together for a small amount of time. And but as soon as she started doing the Japanese house stuff, it was like it kicked into a new gear. She kind of changed she kind of created the new kind of image for her music, and just like it turned from being we stopped doing the Wilbur music, and she kind of created the Japanese house as a brand, I'd say, maybe. And like, you know, just kind of worked more on the whole artistic vision of like her music. And it was just like, and so from there it was, yeah, she'd met Matty and George, and they started working together on the first few EPs. And actually at that point I went to uni to do maths. So I kind of, at that point I'd stopped this idea of doing music. It was just, I mean, music's always like a fun thing that I do it's something that I'll always do, but it was like at the time I didn't really know that I wanted to do music, so I went and did maths because I was like, okay, what am I doing, what could I do, I'll do maths because maths seems like a good thing to do, and it's like it's always useful. I love maths is the best. Math School of Rock, of course.
Very good.
I got halfway through a maths degree and then was like, I have no interest in this whatsoever. So I was like, I was just like, there's no point in doing this because I just have, it's so uninteresting to me. Where especially, you know, where I was at the time. Like now, I think like, I'd actually really enjoy it. It would be great. But, you know, I think at the time I was just so locked on this idea of doing music, and it was like so exciting, and it was just endlessly exciting to me. So I was like, I had to do music. So I dropped out of uni and went back to Amersham College. Great college, Amersham College, if you go there. Awesome. They had, you know, studios, loads of studio rooms where you could just like, they basically, it was fairly loose. The course was, you know, we did lots of like sound design, film sound design, and we like learned how to use Pro Tools. We learned how to use Ableton. We learned how to use Logic. So they gave us like more of a deep dive into, they taught us how to use the softwares and like all the different kind of functions of a modern recording DAW kind of digital audio workspace. So I've just dove into that and got really into like editing audio and like messing around with audio. I was also hugely into like electronic music at that time as well. So I was like, it was so fascinating that I spent the first half of my like teenage years doing like band music. So I was like playing bass or playing drums, playing guitar in a band, arranging songs. And then when I was about 16, it probably started when I was like 16, I just like started discovering all these electronic artists, and I was like, how, what, you know, it's just like amazed that it was, you know, it's sort of, you know, the exploratory worlds of electronic music were just like so exciting. And then it kind of opened me up to the idea of like, oh, that bands are, you know, there's such a key part of music is the recording process. And all these bands that I love have gone through this phase of like, okay, we have these ideas. How do we like present these ideas? And that, you know, and that it's always a result of going through, you know, recording. You have to like learn how to use recording equipment. So.
Hi everyone, it's Darcy again. I'm just interrupting the episode briefly to let you know that our merch line is available right now. We have hoodies, mugs, notebooks, tote bags, stickers, t-shirts, anything you can imagine online right now to help you support the podcast. So head to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me to go grab yourself some lovely Stage Left merch and help us support the podcast so that we can keep producing free and educational content for you all. I won't keep you too long, so let's get back to the episode.
What's your tip for musicians to finish a song? So in my research, I found out that Amber said that she learned about finishing songs from watching the 1975 kind of obsess over that final 10%. Mm-hmm. And they'll all, you know, any musician or producer on this call, right? Or sorry, on this, watching this podcast right now, will be thinking of a time where they've got like a finished version and it's version 78.
Finished,
right?
Yeah.
What's your rule? How do you, because there's a lot of great art, I think, that probably hasn't been released because people are obsessing over this kind of final, that they're too close to it. So what's your tip around that?
Yeah, my tip would be help, get someone else to comment, bring someone in to be like, that's done, you know, because actually I think probably what Matthew and George have, which is amazing, is that they work together and they are able to just like get through decisions like that. And that was a massive thing for Amber. Amber would have got all of her songs to 99% finished, but actually George coming in and being like, that's good, that's bad. And just having another set of eyes to be like, that you don't need to do that. You can stop doing that. That's finished. That's done. And just giving you that kind of confirmation that you've done enough to get it, to get the idea across. Because it's like, I join the rest of the pool of musicians that have like a back catalogue of music that just is sitting on my hard drive, and I just don't know. You know, it's just sat there. So it's like getting to a point where you're like, okay, this is, I can release this and it's like finished, is probably only made for me personally. I would love to work to a place where I'm able to work on my own stuff and get to, you know, where I'm able to finish stuff and be like, okay, I'm finished with it. This is the finished product. I'm putting it out as a single, bam. But it's like, that actually is such, that's where record labels come in. And it's like, that's where mixing engineers, I mean, everyone that I've worked with has this process of basically they'll have a song 90, you know, 99% finished, but they'll just having a mixing engineer or a mastering engineer or a label to be like, okay, we need to just, it's mainly in like the conversations that you have around it to be like, how, you know, this is what you're, it's like you're, it's like having a printer, you know, you're printing out, it's a physical copy, and just giving it to someone else, having someone else's eyes on it and ears on it. That is the final, if that will tell you if it's done. Like,
yeah.
you'll be able
delegate that decision to someone else, basically. Just get it, yeah. Someone else to do that, make that decision. It's such good advice.
And like, you know, send it to a friend or like send it out to some friends. I'm always like sending music to friends. I remember when I was younger, I was just like sending out demos to people. And I still do it now with all my, you know, all my musician friends. I'm always just like sending them versions of songs that I've got and sending them singles. But it's like, or, you know, sending them bounces of stuff that I've done. And it's always like, often the best, the music that I probably like the most is the version that I just do in like 10 minutes and then I'll send out. Or if someone asks me to do something and I'll be like, okay, sure. And just like spend 10 minutes doing something and send it to them. That is always the instances where I'm like, where we're both like, that's fucking sick. That's so cool. You know, whereas like if I've spent ages on it by myself with headphones mixing, then it's good. Sometimes it'll come out and it'll sound good. But honestly, the immediacy of having like that quick motion is like so much better than like a long drawn out sort of like scenario. Obviously, you know, I'm at the bottom of the ladder in terms of like my advice comes from a place where I've only just started releasing my own music. So it's like I've worked on music with everyone, you know, with, yeah, I've seen the process. I've worked with, been working with Amber through the first record she worked on and through the EPs. So that was like, I saw how that kind of like went on between her and George, just like sending stuff back and just working together in the studio. And then when I started working with Declan, he'd actually just finished a record with James Ford, amazing producer, yeah. I just met him again at the Mercury Awards. He was at the Mercury Awards. And he did a single for Declan. British Bombs was with James Ford. So we did that recording session together. And again, he's like so good. I mean, James Ford is amazing. He's like, he's put out probably, you know, he's worked with, I think at the Mercury Awards, he was sat there watching. They were like, next nominee is, you know, Fontaine's DC, that of course produced by James Ford. And then next artist is I've forgotten her name now, the lady from Portishead. What's her name?
Oh, Beth.
Beth, yes, yeah. Beth Gibbs. Yeah. Is it Gibbs? Yeah.
Gibbons,
yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Music knowledge is terrible. Yeah, also produced by James Ford. And it was just like the
one after
one after that. And the sort of juxtaposition, the range of music that he's been able to work on is amazing. So, you know, but that's probably because he's like not as, I mean, he's obviously connected, but just he's a mixing engineer, he's a producer. So, you know, I think if you're creating something, actually giving someone else there's so much that goes into like making a record that actually if you're able to allow someone else to like make a decision for you on your music, it's just going to accelerate where it goes. And what I've found as well is like make it, you know, I've the advance that I've made in my music since I've like found a mixing engineer that I can work with. I've started working with a guy, Darren Jones, who's absolutely amazing mixing engineer. He's just like so good at like, he just glues everything together and just like incredible engineer. So he knows, and he's able to just like put things into a session and make them sound so clean across the boards. Like you can listen to it on a phone or on a speaker or on whatever system, and it just sounds like the song. You know, there's no like, oh, the bass sounds a bit weird on the phone or whatever, you know. And like that skill is a totally different skill to like a music making skill, like a creative skill. So, you know, since I've met him and thought, actually, you know what, delegate, you know, being like, you know, sending something to a mixing engineer. And I suppose that's a piece of advice I would give to a musician is, yeah, find people that are into making records and find people that are like aspiring mixing engineers and aspiring musicians or like sound guys, you know, front of house engineers. They are people that want to, you know, balance audio and are basically like there for a vision of like balanced sound. So if you want to find like a, and if you want to put music out, that's what you want. You want to basically, you know, a live event is essentially it's a different model. It's like a different model of the same structure. You know, the musicians are creating and they're creating the music, and then it's getting sent to a front of house engineer. Front of house engineer sat there and he's putting it out through the speakers, and then the audience are hearing the music. So it's like you can't be the front of house engineer if you're the musician. So there's always going to be this like, I mean, yeah, there's always that structure is so intrinsic to the music industry of having, you know, a group of people, multiple people working on the design of this like music experience. So
with that in mind, if you were to hypothetically, I know there are three different projects in different eras, but a rehearsal for a Japanese house show versus a rehearsal for a Declan show versus a rehearsal for like a new tour with CMAT, what do each of those front people need from you that's different from show to show or from gig to gig?
Yeah, I mean, they've all been such different like musical experiences. I suppose like working with Amber, it was very much, I was working on the, her music's so heavily like has like such a heavy it's like got such rich production on it. Like George is such a producer, and Amber as well. She's so into these like electronic sounds that it's like most of my work on that first bit of the show was basically, well, the first iteration of the band, which I was involved with, was basically just designing a show that would basically create a band. It would be like, okay, there's so many different layers going on in this music. How do we, which parts do we pick out as like a playable part, and how do we play it? How do we play this? Because it's like, we, you know, I was basically diving into the stems and picking out, there's so many layers of different synths. I was like, it was mainly just like using Ableton Live, but, and just like, you know, creating stacks of different synth sounds and then being able to like jump between sounds. And instead of like having, you know, a hardware synth, it was like a, you know, digital software synth that I was able to just like jump through all the different samples and sounds from the records and just play them, but make them kind of playable. So it was like, you know, it was like listening to the records. You want to be listening to the records. So it was like, okay, we want to be able to create this record live, so we don't want to be like sacrificing any of the sounds for the kind of function, you know, for the format of live. So we're not going to like, you know, we want it to be an exact, we want to be putting out the record sounds, you know. So it was like, so with that, it was a lot of digital in the box kind of like editing and like creating instruments from the records. It was also interpreting the records as in sampling, you know, just a lot of that kind of stuff. And also, like, you know, her vocal stack, she's a massive fan of just like stacking vocals, loads of vocals, which was such a pain to get in live, because it's like, how, you know, and that's such an intrinsic part of her music is these vocal stacks. So we spent ages being like, okay, what can we use? There's all these tools at your disposal. We've got harmonizer pedals, and we've got like playback that we can use, and we've got like all these different vocal effects that you can use. Like, how can we kind of make a blend of all these different things and create something which has the same impact as the records? Because the records were so impactful that we wanted to get the same effect. So yeah, so that was, and we did, and we kind of like, you know, now I was watching a radio session that we did, and I was pretty pleased with it. I was like, It low key quite, you know, I was like, you know, quite pleased. I was like, nice, you did a good job there, Willie. Excellent job. Because it was like, there's this one song called Swim Against the Tide, which has like this, the intro is like this kind of steel drums, like, you know, keys part, which is like beautiful melodic piano part, keys part. But and then underneath it has this whirly part as well. So it's two different sounds. And I set it up so, and then the drums are doing all these like crazy sounds as well. So it's just like a lot of digital sounds going on. And I set it up so that I basically had a pedal which would switch between two sounds. So in the verse, in the, I can't remember how I set it up. So if, you know, the pedal was down, it would be like the steel drum sound. And then when the pedal came up, it would just go to the whirly sound. So intro would be pedal down, steel drums. Then I'd fade it up for the verses and it would go down to this like whirly sound, which was nice. And then the chorus is coming and I've got to spin the bass around and play the bass line that's in the bass line in the chorus. And then it was straight back to the pan pipes, pedal down into the steel drums. So it's like, yeah, massive mission to like get all those sounds coming out of the speakers. But yeah, I felt like I did a pretty good job. I did an okay job at the time, being like one musician, the only other instrumentalist that was working on the gig, you know, at the time. It was like, I was covering a lot of ground there. It was pretty good.
And if you compare that to what you're doing now with CMAT, when I mean, a song I'm obsessed with at the moment is Jamie Oliver, Petrol Station. What an absolute modern classic. Like, it's such a banger, obviously. I can imagine starting that song must be really, like, quite a lot could go wrong, because she obviously has that little line beforehand and then you all come in. Is it straightforward? Did you have to rehearse that a lot, or was it just a case of just give me the key that we're in, I'll sing my line and go straight to it?
Yeah, I mean, it's nice that maybe you've overlooked the idea that we have a click track that comes in. So of course, we've got accountants. So Kira basically has a accountant that goes, Jamie Oliver, it's me going. And actually, I put a sample of Jamie Oliver going, let's cook some beautiful food, you know. And then she comes in with, I was at there. So it's, there's a counting that goes, one, two, three, I was at there. Dun, dun, bah, dun, 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 bah. And then we all lock into this like click track. It's actually, we've kind of gone through an evolution of being like, do we need a click track? Do we want a click track? Because we, for that song, we've got this massive lighting rig. So it's really cool to have like, syncopated lights. I love a good syncopated light show. You know, it's like, it's so cool. So we basically use click tracks so that we can play in time to the lights and there's no movement with things moving out of sync. So, but we're actually, as a band, we're kind of moving to a place where we prefer to play without a click track. And it's actually just like, I mean, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's annoying to have a click track. It's kind of limiting to have just this fixed space that you can play to and there's no like movement in the music. But
it feels like her music would, or the live show would definitely work without a click track. There was obviously some bands, you know, the way you just talked about the stuff you did with Amber, like it's, maybe that wouldn't work quite so well, you know, but you have a lot more. I think there's a slight anarchy in CMAT as a band and her, and I think a click track almost is it's almost kind of the opposite of that in some ways, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I think as we've kind of, as the CMAT band has kind of got bigger, it's and like the crowds are bigger. It's like the production team are basically, it kind of always leads towards that. It's kind of like, okay, the production's getting bigger, so we've got to go on track. We have to use clicks. Everything has to be locked in, and it has to be the same every time. But actually, CMAT's music, it's, and CMAT's like performance style, it does not lead to, you know, it actually doesn't lend itself to that ethos at all. It's like, actually, the more, if the step beyond that idea of like, consistency is that the good thing about the CMAT live show is that it has that sense of raw energy and it has this loose feel to it. So,
and something could go wrong, right? So, with the track, nothing could go wrong. So, you want that kind of edge of like, where could this go? Could this, you know,
and it can stop. Like, we do so many, every gig we're doing, we'll stop the show and Kira will pull someone out to just comment on their hat or their outfit or, you know, or there was one night in Cambridge where she picked someone out in the audience that had a sign that said Nashville. And she was like, we've got to, she looked around at us and said, come on, we've got to play Nashville. And we were all like, we haven't rehearsed Nashville. We rehearsed two other songs that were different because we'd already rehearsed two separate songs because we wanted to, well, Kira wanted to change the set list to play some old songs from the first album. Yeah. So we went through this like excruciating, it was probably about 5 seconds, but it felt like 2 minutes of like everyone trying to figure out what key the song was in. We were like, okay, we're playing it in B, right? It's in B, yeah? Or, you know, and then, so yeah, it was excruciating, but it probably was only about 3 seconds of like, okay, how do we play this? This is how we play this, okay.
So what I'd like you to do is give us all the equivalent of a VR headset for your Glastonbury show that you played. So iconic show got a really great billing. For those aren't aware, the CMAC Glastonbury show was shown at like a really peak time on, I think you played Friday, I think it was.
Yeah, and Friday at like two o'clock.
It's so well kind of documented as a great show.
Yeah,
I know you've played Glastonbury before with Declan, but talk us through, imagine, you know, there's loads of musicians here now who are listening to this.
Hey,
put us on a VR, put on a VR headset for us and walk us through that day and that gig, kind of before, during and after.
Yeah. What an amazing thing to go through. Thank you for giving me this experience of going through that day again. It was literally one of the best days of my life. It was so fun. It was really cool. Just such an amazing experience to like full circle to be like, you know, to go through, I had one of these moments where I thought through my whole life on that day. It was like, it was so good. It was amazing. But yeah, it did start off pretty stress induced, I would say, because it was like, we just finished this run of shows. Oh, sorry, I was touching the microphone probably. We just started the day with this massive technical issue because our keyboard wasn't working, so I had to basically go in, we had to do a load of firmware updates and like backup refreshing and stuff like this, so which was
sounds
fine.
Familiar.
Yeah, it's like normal stuff that happens on gigs all the time, so it was just like, it was kind of annoying that it was like the biggest show that we've ever done ever, and it's gonna happen ever, and we had like a technical issue. But in some sense, it was kind of it was nice because it was like, oh, okay, we've got something to focus on. We can like, we don't have to like live through the nerves of like playing the biggest show we've ever played in front of the biggest crowd on the biggest stage of all time ever, and that's fine, you know. I'm just gonna look at this computer instead of thinking about that, you know. But yes, it was, I kind of, the build up to it was like massive because obviously you're thinking about it as like this mammoth experience, you know, this mammoth thing. It's a huge pyramid and it's like something that you idolize, that I idolize. I didn't even think, it's just like, you know, such an obscure, abstract idea, that the pyramid stage. And then to be like, okay, you're going to go on there and play a show. You're going to do one of your gigs on that stage. It was just like, Steph, it was insane. It was like being like, okay, you're going to just dip a few strokes on the Mona Lisa. You're just going to like add a little bit on the top, you know? It's like, why would I do that? How can I do that? How do you do that? I don't know. But yeah, we stepped into it. We went into the dressing rooms. It was all like really lovely, nice. And it actually, as soon as I got on stage, because I went to backstage, I was setting up all our stuff like we do for any gig, and it was like actually really relaxed. I was like, wow, this is just like any other gig. I mean, I do actually, once I get into like gig mode, I'm basically, I don't have to, you know, it's kind of like, well, it's the same as any other gig. So I wasn't really thinking too much about the grandeur of everything. I was just like, okay, I've got to do this and this and this and this. And I have to just set everything up. So, you know, I was kind of locked into just setting things up once we got there. But it was, but it was pretty incredible. You know, there'd be like the odd 5 seconds where I'd be like, you know, I'd be setting up our laptop to do our time code. And then I'd be like, looking up at the top of the rigging, in the internal rigging, you can just look up there and be like, wow, this is where Neil Young's going to be. This is where, you know, T-Rex will have played and Bowie would have like been here in the 70s and like, you know, just all these thoughts. I had such a sort of, you know, we just cycled through time being like, and it made it so real. It was just like that, you know, you idolize these people because they're your idols, like, you know, David Bowie and, you know, all these, Mark Bolan, all these guys. It's like they're such, it's a vision, you know, it's like they're so revered by me and millions that it's like they're almost abstract to human, you know, conception. It's like they're not real. But then you get to the pyramid stage and you see, it was like stepping on a stage and being like, wow, they really were just like guys like that were doing the same as all us. We're in bands. We're on such a, we'll never be making the same music. But did they think they were making music? They were probably just like, we're making music. We're doing this. They didn't think at the time, like, this is going to be the biggest thing ever. They were just like living in the moment and loving the music they're making. And it's like, and so that's what you got to do, baby. It's just like, do what they did and just like be super in it and just like go for it, you know, just like go for it. So yeah, we walked up there and stepped out onto the stage and I remember immediately walking out. I don't actually remember. Like, I spoke to someone recently and they said they were watching the footage and I apparently just walked straight up to the front of the stage and just like soaked in the massive crowd and was just like, what's up? Yeah. And I kind of must have just been on autopilot, just like, yeah, okay, here we are. But it was like, you know, it was amazing. It was just like, yeah, it almost felt surreal. It was like being in a film. It was like you were, you know, just in a different space. You were just like totally, and it was mad. Looking at each other, it was crazy. Because as soon as we looked at each other, we were like, we're doing this. Yeah, this is really happening. We're actually on the pyramid stage right now. Have you seen this? There's like 60,000 people over there. And we're going to play the song. So come on, here we go. So, you know, and everyone was like, and it's so nice at that point. We're all so tense and so nervous and like, what are we doing? But then you remember, well, we're playing songs and we know these songs. So we can just play these songs. Great. Okay. Let's just like play the songs. Wicked. Cool.
And what about straight after? So you've just finished it. What do you remember of the hour afterwards and the day afterwards?
I remember, well, just to go back to the show, I remember at one point I kind of lost focus of what I was doing because I was like, I thought of myself as an 11-year-old holding my first Yamaha guitar. And as I was holding my 2011 Thunderbird bass, I was like, you're doing the same thing. You're doing it, man. You're fucking doing it, dude. And I got super emotional. I was like, fuck. Shit, okay, I have to focus now. Stop thinking about that because you'll start crying and then you'll just be emotional. But then put that into what you're doing because that's a good thing. So, you know, just be present, you know. And then afterwards, we played the rest of the set. And then, afterwards, we all came off. It was kind of like we'd all been punched in the face. It was like we were all just like, whoa, oh my God. It was like stars around our heads, insane. And everyone just kind of scattered and was like, what the hell? What the flip was that? Oh my God, insane. I don't think Kira even said anything. I think Kira was just like, it was like shell shock. Yeah, it was crazy. I think it was such a massive experience to go through that everyone was just had no words to put on to. It was speechless. It was like
you smashed it.
And we've done
like,
really good. Yeah,
like it was like objectively, yeah, most people were just like, that was, yeah, one of the sets of the entire weekend, and they kept repeating on BBC all weekend. Mm. They kept looping back to it, and yeah, yeah. I mean, and you absolutely nailed it.
That was good. Yeah, that felt very good.
Well, so it sounds like it's an experience that will live with you forever. And, you know, go back to yourself, sure, as a young person, you know, first picking up that bass and, you know, think those sliding doors moments, you know, would that have happened if Amber hadn't got her fingers trapped in the door? Maybe, maybe not. You never know from that situation. Those
literally wouldn't have done. Isn't that insane?
That is crazy, insane. And I just want to say thank you for all your wisdom, your insight, your vulnerability, sharing all that great knowledge that you have with our listeners. Get rid of the click track with Seema. I think that's in our decision.
Yeah,
I'm going to do that. And I just want to say thank you for being such an amazing guest on the Stage Jeff podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Yeah, it's such a great chat. Thanks so much for, yeah, letting me ramble on about my meek existence in the music spectrum, you know, the plethora of music that's happening right now. It's great to be chatting with you about the stuff that I've been so lucky to have been involved with. So yeah, it's really, thank you for chatting. It's been brilliant.
Hi everyone, I hope you enjoyed the episode, but just before you go, I want to drop in again and say that our brand new merch line is available right now. So head to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me to check out all our new hoodies, t-shirts, mugs, stickers, tote bags, notebooks to help support the podcast. If you could go over there and check that out and maybe purchase something, it's an amazing way to help support us and keep us going so that we can produce free and educational content for you all about the music industry, which really helps a lot of young musicians and people looking to get into the industry. All of the merch is great. I love it. I have the hoodie here, but I've also got one of our notebooks, and it's just a great way of helping support us and keep us going as well. So I'd be greatly appreciated if you could head over to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me and have a little look at all of our merch. It would be so appreciated. So I hope you enjoyed the episode there, and go check out our brand new merch. Thank you for watching.